Tendant agreed. There's the train starting over there with another load. She was not watching the train. She saw the man below looking at her. She saw the insolent hint of amusement tell her that he knew she did not want him to look at her now. She turned her head away. The superintendent's eyes traveled over the pit and stopped on the man below them. "Hey, you down there," he shouted. "Are you paid to work or to gape?" The man bent silently over his drill. Dominique laughed aloud. The superintendent said, "It's a tough crew we got down here, Miss Francone. Some of them even with jail records."
"Has that man a jail record?" she asked, pointing down.
"Well, I couldn't say. Wouldn't know them all by sight."
She hoped he had.
She wondered whether they whipped convicts nowadays.
She hoped they did. At the thought of it, she felt a sinking gasp, such as she had felt in childhood, in dreams of falling down a long stairway. But she felt the sinking in her stomach.
She turned brusquely and left the quarry.
She came back many days later. She saw him unexpectedly on a flat stretch of stone before her by the side of the path. She stopped short. She did not want to come too close. It was strange to see him before her, without the defense and excuse of distance. He stood looking straight at her. Their understanding was too offensively intimate, because they had never said a word to each other. She destroyed it by speaking to him.
"Why do you always stare at me?" she asked sharply.
She thought with relief that words were the best means of estrangement. She had denied everything they both knew by naming it. For a moment, he stood silently looking at her. She felt terror at the thought that he would not answer, that he would let his silence tell her too clearly why no answer was necessary. But he answered. He said,
"For the same reason you've been staring at me."
"I don't know what you're talking about."
"If you didn't, you'd be much more astonished and much less angry, Miss Francone."
"So you know my name?"
"You've been advertising it loudly enough."
"You'd better not be insolent. I can have you fired at a moment's notice, you know."
He turned his head, looking for someone among the men below. He asked,
"Shall I call the superintendent?"
She smiled contemptuously.
"No, of course not. It would be too simple. But since you know who I am, it would be better if you stopped looking at me when I come here. It might be misunderstood."
"I don't think so."
She turned away. She had to control her voice. She looked over the stone ledges. She asked,
"Do you find it very hard to work here?"
"Yes, terribly."
"Do you get tired?"
"Inhumanly."
"How does that feel?"
"I can hardly walk when the day's ended. I can't move my arms at night. When I lie in bed, I can count every muscle in my body by the number of separate, different pains."
She knew suddenly that he was not telling her about himself. He was speaking of her. He was saying the things she wanted to hear, and telling her that he knew why she wanted to hear these particular sentences. She felt anger, a satisfying anger, because it was cold and certain. She felt also a desire to let her skin touch his, to let the length of her bare arm press against the length of his. Just that. The desire went no further. She was asking calmly,
"You don't belong here, do you? You don't talk like a worker. What were you before?"
"An electrician, a plumber, a plasterer, many things."
"Why are you working here?"
"For the money you're paying me, Miss Francone."
She shrugged. She turned and walked away from him up the path. She knew that he was looking after her. She did not glance back. She continued on her way through the quarry, and she left it as soon as she could. But she did not go back down the path where she would have to see him again.
Chapter 2
Dominique awakened each morning to the prospect of a day made significant by the existence of a goal to be reached, the goal of making it a day on which she would not go to the quarry. She had lost the freedom she loved. She knew that a continuous struggle against the compulsion of a single desire was compulsion also. But it was the form she preferred to accept. It was the only manner in which she could let him motivate her life. She found a dark satisfaction in pain, because that pain came from him. She went to call on her distant neighbors, a wealthy, gracious family who had bored her in New York. She had visited no one all summer.
They were astonished and delighted to see her. She sat among a group of distinguished people at the edge of a swimming pool. She watched the air of fastidious elegance around her. She watched the deference of these people's manner when they spoke to her. She glanced at her own reflection in the pool. She looked more delicately austere than any among them. And she thought with a vicious thrill of what these people would do if they read her mind in this moment, if they knew that she was thinking of a man in a quarry, thinking of his body with a sharp intimacy as one does not think of another's body, but only of one's own. She smiled. The cold purity of her face prevented them from seeing the nature of that smile. She came back again to visit these people, for the sake of such thoughts and the presence of their respect for her. One evening, a guest offered to drive her back to her house. He was an eminent young poet. He was pale and slender. He had a soft, sensitive mouth and eyes, hurt by the whole universe. She had not noticed the wistful attention with which he had watched her for a long time. As they drove through the twilight, she saw him leaning hesitantly closer to her. She heard his voice whispering the pleading, incoherent things she had heard from many men. He stopped the car. She felt his lips pressed to her shoulder. She jerked away from him. She sat still for an instant, because she would have to brush against him if she moved, and she could not bear to touch him. Then she flung the door open, she leaped out, she slammed the door behind her as if the crash of sound could wipe him out of existence, and she ran, blindly. She stopped running after a while, and she walked on, shivering. Walked down the dark road until she saw the roof line of her own house. She stopped, looking about her with her first coherent thought of astonishment. Such incidents had happened to her often in the past. Only then she had been amused. She had felt no revulsion. She had felt nothing. She walked slowly across the lawn to the house. On the stairs to her room, she stopped. She thought of the man in the quarry. She thought, in clear, formed words, that the man in the quarry wanted her. She had known it before. She had known it with his first glance at her. But she had never stated the knowledge to herself. She laughed. She looked about her at the silent splendor of her house. The house made the words preposterous. She knew what would never happen to her, and she knew the kind of suffering she could impose on him. For days, she walked with satisfaction through the rooms of her house. It was her defense. She heard the explosions of blasting from the quarry, and smiled. But she felt too certain, and the house was too safe. She felt a desire to underscore the safety by challenging it. She chose the marble slab in front of the fireplace in her bedroom. She wanted it broken. She knelt, hammer in hand, and tried to smash the marble. She pounded it, her thin arms sweeping high over her head, crashing down with ferocious helplessness. She felt the pain in the bones of her arms, in her shoulder sockets. She succeeded in making a long scratch across the marble. She went to the quarry. She saw him from a distance and walked straight to him. "Hello," she said casually. He stopped the drill. He leaned against a stone shelf. He answered, "Hello." "I have been thinking of you," she said softly, and stopped, then added, her voice flowing on in the same tone of compelling invitation, "because there's a bit of a dirty job to be done at my house. Would you like to make some extra money?"
"Certainly, Miss Francone."
"Will you come to my house tonight? The way to the servants' entrance is off Ridgewood Road. There's a marble piece at a fireplace that's broken and has to be replaced. I want you to take it out and order a new one made for me."
She expected anger and refusal. He asked, "What time shall I come?"
"At 7 o'clock." "What are you paid here?"
62 cents an hour."
"I'm sure you're worth that. I'm quite willing to pay you at the same rate. Do you know how to find my house?"
"No, Miss Francone."
"Just ask anyone in the village to direct you."
"Yes, Miss Francone."
She walked away disappointed. She felt that their secret understanding was lost. He had spoken as if it were a simple job which she could have offered to any other workman. Then she felt the sinking gasp inside, that feeling of shame and pleasure which he always gave her. She realized that their understanding had been more intimate and flagrant than ever. in his natural acceptance of an unnatural offer. He had shown her how much he knew, by his lack of astonishment. She asked her old caretaker and his wife to remain in the house that evening. Their diffident presence completed the picture of a feudal mansion. She heard the bell of the servants' entrance at 7 o'clock. The old woman escorted him to the great front hall, where Dominique stood on the landing of a broad stairway. She watched him approaching, looking up at her. She held the pose long enough to let him suspect that it was a deliberate pose, deliberately planned. She broke it at the exact moment before he could become certain of it. She said, "Good evening." Her voice was austerely quiet. He did not answer, but inclined his head and walked on up the stairs toward her. He wore his work clothes, and he carried a bag of tools. His movements had a swift, relaxed kind of energy that did not belong here in her house on the polished steps, between the delicate, rigid banisters. She had expected him to seem incongruous in her house, but it was the house that seemed incongruous around him. She moved one hand, indicating the door of her bedroom. He followed obediently. He did not seem to notice the room when he entered. He entered it as if it were a workshop. He walked straight to the fireplace. "There it is," she said, one finger pointing to the marble slab. He said nothing. He knelt, took a thin metal wedge from his bag, held its point against the scratch on the slab, took a hammer, and struck one blow. The marble split in a long, deep cut. He glanced up at her. It was the look she dreaded, a look of laughter that could not be answered, because the laughter could not be seen, only felt. He said, "Now it's broken and has to be replaced." She asked calmly, "Would you know what kind of marble this is and where to order another piece like it?"
"Yes, Miss Francone."
"Go ahead, then. Take it out."
"Yes, Miss Francone."
She stood watching him. It was strange to feel a senseless necessity to watch the mechanical process of the work, as if her eyes were helping it. Then she knew that she was afraid to look at the room around them. She made herself raise her head. She saw the shelf of her dressing table, its glass edge like a narrow green satin ribbon in the semi-darkness, and the crystal containers. She saw a pair of white bedroom slippers, a pale blue towel on the floor by a mirror, a pair of stockings thrown over the arm of a chair. She saw the white satin cover of her bed. His shirt had damp stains and gray patches of stone dust. The dust made streaks on the skin of his arms. She felt as if each object in the room had been touched by him, as if the air were a heavy pool of water into which they had been plunged together, and the water that touched him carried the touch to her, to every object in the room. She wanted him to look up. He worked without raising his head. She approached him and stood silently over him. She had never stood so close to him before. She looked down at the smooth skin on the back of his neck. She could distinguish single threads of his hair. She glanced down at the tip of her sandal. It was there on the floor, an inch away from his body. She needed but one movement, a very slight movement of her foot, to touch him. She made a step back. He moved his head, but not to look up, only to pick another tool from the bag, and bent over his work again. She laughed aloud. He stopped and glanced at her.
"Yes?" he asked.
Her face was grave, her voice gentle, when she answered, "Oh, I'm sorry. You might have thought that I was laughing at you. But I wasn't, of course." She added, "I didn't want to disturb you. I'm sure you're anxious to finish and get out of here. I mean, of course, because you must be tired. But then, on the other hand, I'm paying you by the hour, so it's quite all right if you stretch your time a little, if you want to make more out of it. There must be things you'd like to talk about."
"Oh, yes, Miss Francone."
"Well?"
"I think this is an atrocious fireplace."
"Really? This house was designed by my father."
"Yes, of course, Miss Francone."
"There's no point in your discussing the work of an architect."
"None at all."
"Surely we could choose some other subject."
"Yes, Miss Francone."
She moved away from him. She sat down on the bed, leaning back on straight arms, her legs crossed and pressed close together in a long straight line. Her body, sagging limply from her shoulders, contradicted the inflexible precision of the legs. The cold austerity of her face contradicted the pose of her body. He glanced at her occasionally as he worked. He was speaking obediently. He was saying,
"I shall make certain to get a piece of marble of precisely the same quality, Miss Francone. It is very important to distinguish between the various kinds of marble. Generally speaking, there are three kinds. The white marbles, which are derived from the recrystallization of limestone, the onyx marbles, which are chemical deposits of calcium carbonate, and the green marbles, which consist mainly of hydrous magnesium silicate, or serpentine. This last must not be considered as true marble. True marble is a metamorphic form of limestone produced by heat and pressure. Pressure is a powerful factor. It leads to consequences which, once started, cannot be controlled."
"What consequences?" she asked, leaning forward.
"The recrystallization of the particles of limestone and the infiltration of foreign elements from the surrounding soil. These constitute the colored streaks which are to be found in most marbles. Pink marble is caused by the presence of manganese oxides. Gray marble is due to carbonaceous matter. Yellow marble is attributed to a hydrous oxide of iron. This piece here is, of course, white marble. There are a great many varieties of white marble. You should be very careful, Miss Francone."
She sat leaning forward, gathered into a dim black huddle. The lamplight fell on one hand she had dropped limply on her knees, palm up, the fingers half closed. A thin edge of fire outlining each finger, the dark cloth of her dress making the hand too naked and brilliant.
"To make certain that I order a new piece of precisely the same quality. It would not be advisable, for instance, to substitute a piece of white Georgia marble, which is not as fine-grained as the white marble of Vermont, which is not as fine-grained as the white marble of Alabama. This is Alabama marble. Very high grade. Very expensive."
He saw her hand close and drop down, out of the light. He continued his work in silence. When he had finished, he rose, asking,
"Where shall I put the stone?"
"Leave it there. I'll have it removed."
"I'll order a new piece, cut to measure, and delivered to you COD. Do you wish me to set it?"
"Yes, certainly. I'll let you know when it comes. How much do I owe you?" She glanced at a clock on her bedside table. "Let me see, you've been here 3/4 of an hour. That's 48 cents. She reached for her bag. She took out a dollar bill and she handed it to him. "Keep the change," she said. She hoped he would throw it back in her face. He slipped the bill into his pocket. He said,
"Thank you, Miss Francone."
He saw the edge of her long black sleeve trembling over her closed fingers. "Good night," she said, her voice hollow in anger. He bowed.
"Good night, Miss Francone."
He turned and walked down the stairs, out of the house. She stopped thinking of him. She thought of the piece of marble he had ordered. She waited for it to come with the feverish intensity of a sudden mania. She counted the days. She watched the rare trucks on the road beyond the lawn. She told herself fiercely that she merely wanted the marble to come. Just that, nothing else, no hidden reasons, no reasons at all. It was a last hysterical aftermath. She was free of everything else. The stone would come, and that would be the end. When the stone came, she barely glanced at it. The delivery truck had not left the grounds when she was at her desk writing a note on a piece of exquisite stationery. She wrote, "The marble is here. I want it set tonight." She sent her caretaker with the note to the quarry. She ordered it delivered to, I don't know his name, the red-headed workman who was here. The caretaker came back and brought her a scrap torn from a brown paper bag, bearing in pencil,
"You'll have it set tonight."
She waited in the suffocating emptiness of impatience at the window of her bedroom. The servant's entrance bell rang at 7 o'clock. There was a knock at her door. "Come in," she snapped, to hide the strange sound of her own voice. The door opened, and the caretaker's wife entered, motioning for someone to follow. The person who followed was a short, squat, middle-aged Italian with bow legs, a gold hoop in one ear, and a frayed hat held respectfully in both hands.
"The man sent from the quarry, Miss Francone," said the caretaker's wife.
Dominique asked, her voice not a scream and not a question,
"Who are you?"
"Pasquale Orsini," the man answered obediently, bewildered.
"What do you want?"
Well, I... Well, Red down at the quarry said fireplace gotta be fixed. He said, you want I fix her.
Yes, yes, of course, she said, rising. I forgot. Go ahead.
She had to get out of the room. She had to run, not to be seen by anyone, not to be seen by herself if she could escape it. She stopped somewhere in the garden and stood trembling, pressing her fists against her eyes. It was anger. It was a pure single emotion that swept everything clean, everything but the terror under the anger. Terror, because she knew that she could not go near the quarry now, and that she would go. It was early evening, many days later, when she went to the quarry. She returned on horseback from a long ride through the country, and she saw the shadows lengthening on the lawn. She knew that she could not live through another night. She had to get there before the workers left. She wheeled about. She rode to the quarry flying, the wind cutting her cheeks. He was not there when she reached the quarry. She knew at once that he was not there, even though the workers were just leaving and a great many of them were filing down the paths from the stone bowl. She stood, her lips tight, and she looked for him. But she knew that he had left. She rode into the woods. She flew at random between walls of leaves that melted ahead in the gathering twilight. She stopped, broke a long thin branch off a tree, tore the leaves off and went on, using the flexible stick as a whip, lashing her horse to fly faster. She felt as if the speed would hasten the evening on, force the hours ahead to pass more quickly, let her leap across time to catch the coming morning before it came. And then she saw him, walking alone on the path before her. She tore ahead. She caught up with him and stopped sharply, the jolt throwing her forward, then back, like the release of a spring. He stopped. They said nothing. They looked at each other. She thought that every silent instant passing was a betrayal. This wordless encounter was too eloquent, this recognition that no greeting was necessary. She asked, her voice flat, "Why didn't you come to set the marble?"
"I didn't think it would make any difference to you who came. Or did it, Miss Francone?"
She felt the words not as sounds, but as a blow flat against her mouth. The branch she held went up and slashed across his face. She started off in the sweep of the same motion. Dominique sat at the dressing table in her bedroom. It was very late. There was no sound in the vast empty house around her. The French windows of the bedroom were open on a terrace, and there was no sound of leaves in the dark garden beyond. The blankets on her bed were turned down waiting for her, the pillow white against the tall black windows. She thought she would try to sleep. She had not seen him for 3 days. She ran her hands over her head, the curves of her palms pressing against the smooth planes of hair. She pressed her fingertips, wet with perfume, to the hollows of her temples and held them there for a moment. She felt relief in the cold, contracting bite of the liquid on her skin. A spilled drop of perfume remained on the glass of the dressing table, a drop sparkling like a gem, and as expensive. She did not hear the sound of steps in the garden. She heard them only when they rose up the stairs to the terrace. She sat up, frowning. She looked at the French windows. He came in. He wore his work clothes, the dirty shirt with rolled sleeves, the trousers smeared with stone dust. He stood looking at her. There was no laughing understanding in his face. His face was drawn, austere in cruelty, ascetic in passion, the cheeks sunken, the lips pulled down, set tight. She jumped to her feet. She stood, her arms thrown back, her fingers spread apart. He didn't move. She saw a vein of his neck rise, beating, and fall down again. Then he walked to her. He held her as if his flesh had cut through hers, and she felt the bones of his arms on the bones of her ribs. Her legs jerked tight against his mouth on hers. She did not know whether the jolt of terror shook her first, and she thrust her elbows at his throat, twisting her body to escape, or whether she lay still in his arms in the first instant, in the shock of feeling his skin against hers, the thing she had thought about, had expected. Had never known to be like this, could not have known, because this was not part of living, but a thing one could not bear longer than a second. She tried to tear herself away from him. The effort broke against his arms that had not felt it. Her fists beat against his shoulders, against his face.
He moved one hand, took her two wrists, pinned them behind her, under his arm, wrenching her shoulder blades. She twisted her head back. She felt his lips on her breast. She tore herself free. She fell back against the dressing table. She stood crouching, her hands clasping the edge behind her, her eyes wide, colorless, shapeless in terror. He was laughing. There was the movement of laughter on his face, but no sound. Perhaps he had released her intentionally. He stood, his legs apart, his arms hanging at his sides, letting her be more sharply aware of his body across the space between them than she had been in his arms. She looked at the door behind him. He saw the first hint of movement, no more than a thought of leaping toward that door. He extended his arm, not touching her, and she fell back. Her shoulders moved faintly, rising. He took a step forward, and her shoulders fell. She huddled lower, closer to the table. He let her wait. Then he approached. He lifted her without effort. She let her teeth sink into his hand, and felt blood on the tip of her tongue. He pulled her head back, and he forced her mouth open against his. She fought like an animal, but she made no sound. She did not call for help. She heard the echoes of her blows and a gasp of his breath, and she knew that it was a gasp of pleasure. She reached for the lamp on the dressing table. He knocked the lamp out of her hand. The crystal burst to pieces in the darkness. He had thrown her down on the bed, and she felt the blood beating in her throat, in her eyes, the hatred, the helpless terror in her blood. She felt the hatred and his hands moving over her body, the hands that broke granite. She fought in a last convulsion. Then the sudden pain shot up through her body to her throat, and she screamed. Then she lay still. It was an act that could be performed in tenderness, as a seal of love, or in contempt, as a symbol of humiliation and conquest. It could be the act of a lover, or the act of a soldier violating an enemy woman. He did it as an act of scorn, not as love, but as defilement. And this made her lie still and submit. One gesture of tenderness from him, and she would have remained cold, untouched by the thing done to her body. But the act of a master taking shameful, contemptuous possession of her was the kind of rapture she had wanted. Then she felt him shaking with the agony of a pleasure unbearable even to him. She knew that she had given that to him, that it came from her, from her body. And she bit his lips, and she knew what he had wanted her to know. He lay still across the bed, away from her, his head hanging back over the edge. She heard the slow, ending gasps of his breath. She lay on her back as he had left her, not moving, her mouth open. She felt empty, light, and flat. She saw him get up. She saw his silhouette against the window. He went out without a word or a glance at her. She noticed that, but it did not matter. She listened blankly to the sound of his steps moving away in the garden. She lay still for a long time. Then she moved her tongue in her open mouth. She heard a sound that came from somewhere within her, and it was the dry, short, sickening sound of a sob. But she was not crying. Her eyes were held paralyzed, dry, and open. The sound became motion, a jolt running down her throat to her stomach. It flung her up. She stood awkwardly bent over, her forearms pressed to her stomach. She heard the small table by the bed rattling in the darkness, and she looked at it, in empty astonishment that a table should move without reason. Then she understood that she was shaking. She was not frightened. It seemed foolish to shake like that, in short, separate jerks, like soundless hiccups. She thought she must take a bath. The need was unbearable, as if she had felt it for a long time. Nothing mattered, if only she would take a bath. She dragged her feet slowly to the door of her bathroom. She turned the light on in the bathroom. She saw herself in a tall mirror. She saw the purple bruises left on her body by his mouth. She heard a moan muffled in her throat, not very loud. It was not the sight, but the sudden flash of knowledge. She knew that she would not take a bath. She knew that she wanted to keep the feeling of his body, the traces of his body on hers, knowing also what such a desire implied. She fell on her knees, clasping the edge of the bathtub. She could not make herself crawl over that edge. Her hands slipped. She lay still on the floor.
The tiles were hard and cold under her body. She lay there till morning. Rourke awakened in the morning and thought that last night had been like a point reached, like a stop in the movement of his life. He was moving forward for the sake of such stops, like the moments when he had walked through the half-finished Heller house. Like last night. In some unstated way, last night had been what building was to him. In some quality of reaction within him. In what it gave to his consciousness of existence. They had been united in an understanding beyond the violence, beyond the deliberate obscenity of his action. Had she meant less to him, he would not have taken her as he did. Had he meant less to her, she would not have fought so desperately. The unrepeatable exultation was in knowing that they both understood this. He went to the quarry, and he worked that day as usual. She did not come to the quarry, and he did not expect her to come, but the thought of her remained. He watched it with curiosity. It was strange to be conscious of another person's existence, to feel it as a close, urgent necessity, a necessity without qualifications, neither pleasant nor painful, merely final, like an ultimatum. It was important to know that she existed in the world. It was important to think of her, of how she had awakened this morning, of how she moved, with her body still his, now his forever, of what she thought. That evening at dinner in the sooted kitchen, he opened a newspaper and saw the name of Roger Enright in the lines of a gossip column. He read the short paragraph. "It looks like another grand project on its way to the wastebasket." Roger Enright, the oil king, seems to be stumped this time. He'll have to call a halt to his latest pipe dream of an Enright house. Architect trouble, we are told. Seems as if half a dozen of the big building boys have been shown the gate by the unsatisfiable Mr. Enright. Top-notchers, all of them. Rourke felt the wrench he had tried so often to fight, not to let it hurt him too much. The wrench of helplessness before the vision of what he could do, what should have been possible and was closed to him. Then, without reason, he thought of Dominique Francon. She had no relation to the things in his mind. He was shocked only to know that she could remain present even among these things. A week passed. Then one evening, he found a letter waiting for him at home. It had been forwarded from his former office to his last New York address, from there to Mike, from Mike to Connecticut. The engraved address of an oil company on the envelope meant nothing to him. He opened the letter. He read, "Dear Mr. Rourke, I have been endeavoring for some time to get in touch with you, but have been unable to locate you. Please communicate with me at your earliest convenience. I should like to discuss with you my proposed Enright house, if you were the man who built the Fargo store. Sincerely yours, Roger Enright." Half an hour later, Rourke was on a train. When the train started moving, he remembered Dominique and that he was leaving her behind. The thought seemed distant and unimportant. He was astonished only to know that he still thought of her, even now. She could accept, thought Dominique, and come to forget in time everything that had happened to her, save one memory, that she had found pleasure in the thing which had happened, that he had known it, and more, that he had known it before he came to her, and that he would not have come but for that knowledge. She had not given him the one answer that would have saved her, an answer of simple revulsion. She had found joy in her revulsion, in her terror, and in his strength. That was the degradation she had wanted, and she hated him for it. She found a letter one morning waiting for her on the breakfast table. It was from Alva Skerritt. "When are you coming back, Dominique? I can't tell you how much we miss you here. You're not a comfortable person to have around. I'm actually scared of you. But I might as well inflate your inflated ego some more at a distance and confess that we're all waiting for you impatiently. It will be like the homecoming of an empress." She read it and smiled. She thought, if they knew, those people, that old life and that awed reverence before her person. "I've been raped. I've been raped by some red-headed hoodlum from a stone quarry. I, Dominique Francon." Through the fierce sense of humiliation, the words gave her the same kind of pleasure she had felt in his arms. She thought of it when she walked through the countryside, when she passed people on the road, and the people bowed to her, the chatelaine of the house. She wanted to scream it to the hearing of all. She was not conscious of the days that passed. She felt content in a strange detachment, alone with the words she kept repeating to herself. Then, one morning, standing on the lawn in her garden, she understood that a week had passed, and that she had not seen him for a week. She turned and walked rapidly across the lawn to the road. She was going to the quarry. She walked the miles to the quarry, down the road, bareheaded in the sun. She did not hurry. It was not necessary to hurry. It was inevitable to see him again. She had no purpose. The need was too great to name a purpose. Afterward, there were other things, hideous, important things behind her, and rising vaguely in her mind. But first, above all, just one thing, to see him again. She came to the quarry, and she looked slowly, carefully, stupidly about her. Stupidly, because the enormity of what she saw would not penetrate her brain. She saw at once that he was not there. The work was in full swing. The sun was high over the busiest hour of the day. There was not an idle man in sight, but he was not among the men. She stood waiting numbly for a long time. Then she saw the foreman, and she motioned for him to approach.
"Good afternoon, Miss Francone. Lovely day, Miss Francone, isn't it? Just like the middle of summer again, and yet fall's not far away. Yes, fall's coming. Look at the leaves, Miss Francone."
She asked. "There was a man you had here, a man with very bright orange hair. Where is he?"
"Oh, yes, that one. He's gone."
"Gone?"
"Quit. Left for New York, I think. Very suddenly, too."
"When? A week ago?"
"Why, no, just yesterday."
"Who was—"
Then she stopped. She was going to ask, "Who was he?" She asked instead,
"Who was working here so late last night? I heard blasting."
"That was a special order for Mr. Francone's building. The Cosmo Slotnick building, you know. A rush job."
"Yes, I see."
"Sorry it disturbed you, Miss Francone."
"Oh, not at all."
She walked away. She would not ask for his name. It was her last chance of freedom. She walked swiftly, easily, in sudden relief. She wondered why she had never noticed that she did not know his name, and why she had never asked him. Perhaps because she had known everything she had to know about him from that first glance. She thought, one could not find some nameless worker in the city of New York. She was safe. If she knew his name, she would be on her way to New York now. The future was simple. She had nothing to do except never to ask for his name. She had a reprieve. She had a chance to fight. She would break it. Or it would break her. If it did, she would ask for his name. Chapter 3 When Peter Keating entered the office, the opening of the door sounded like a single high blast on a trumpet. The door flew forward, as if it had opened of itself to the approach of a man before whom all doors were to open in such manner. His day in the office began with the newspapers. There was a neat pile of them waiting, stacked on his desk by his secretary. He liked to see what new mentions appeared in print about the progress of the Cosmo Slotnick building, or the firm of Francone and Keating. There were no mentions in the papers this morning, and Keating frowned. He saw, however, a story about Ellsworth M. Toohey. It was a startling story. Thomas L. Foster, noted philanthropist, had died, and had left, among larger bequests, the modest sum of $100,000 to Ellsworth M. Toohey, my friend and spiritual guide, in appreciation of his noble mind and true devotion to humanity. Ellsworth M. Toohey had accepted the legacy, and had turned it over, intact, to the Workshop of Social Study, a progressive institute of learning where he held the post of lecturer on art as a social symptom. He had given the simple explanation that he did not believe in the institution of private inheritance. He had refused all further comment. "No, my friends," he had said, "not about this," and had added, with his charming knack for destroying the earnestness of his own moment, "I like to indulge in the luxury of commenting solely upon interesting subjects. I do not consider myself one of these." Peter Keating read the story. And because he knew that it was an action which he would never have committed, he admired it tremendously.
Then he thought, with a familiar twinge of annoyance, that he had not been able to meet Ellsworth Toohey. Toohey had left on a lecture tour shortly after the award in the Kosmoslotnik competition, and the brilliant gatherings Keating had attended ever since were made empty by the absence of the one man he'd been most eager to meet. No mention of Keating's name had appeared in Toohey's column. Keating turned hopefully, as he did each morning, to One Small Voice in the banner. But One Small Voice was subtitled Songs and Things today, and was devoted to proving the superiority of folk songs over any other form of musical art, and of choral singing over any other manner of musical rendition. Keating dropped the banner. He got up and paced viciously across the office, because he had to turn now to a disturbing problem. He had been postponing it for several mornings. It was the matter of choosing a sculptor for the Kosmoslotnik building. Months ago, the commission for the giant statue of Industry, to stand in the main lobby of the building, had been awarded tentatively to Stephen Mallory. The award had puzzled Keating, but it had been made by Mr. Slotnick, so Keating had approved of it. He had interviewed Mallory and said, "In recognition of your unusual ability, of course you have no name, but you will have, after a commission like this. They don't come every day like this building of mine." He had not liked Mallory. Mallory's eyes were like black holes left after a fire not quite put out, and Mallory had not smiled once. He was 24 years old, had had one show of his work, but not many commissions. His work was strange and too violent. Keating remembered that Ellsworth Toohey had said once, long ago, in One Small Voice, "Mr. Mallory's human figures would have been very fine were it not for the hypothesis that God created the world and the human form. Had Mr. Mallory been entrusted with the job, he might perhaps have done better than the Almighty, if we are to judge by what he passes as human bodies in stone. Or would he?" Keating had been baffled by Mr. Slotnick's choice, until he heard that Dimples Williams had once lived in the same Greenwich Village tenement with Stephen Mallory, and Mr. Slotnick could refuse nothing to Dimples Williams at the moment. Mallory had been hired, had worked, and had submitted a model of his statue of Industry. When he saw it, Keating knew that the statue would look like a raw gash, like a smear of fire in the neat elegance of his lobby. It was the slender, naked body of a man who looked as if he could break through the steel plate of a battleship and through any barrier whatever. It stood like a challenge. It left a strange stamp on one's eyes. It made the people around it seem smaller and sadder than usual. For the first time in his life, looking at that statue, Keating thought he understood what was meant by the word heroic. He said nothing, but the model was sent on to Mr. Slotnick, and many people said with indignation what Keating had felt. Mr. Slotnick asked him to select another sculptor, and left the choice in his hands. Keating flopped down in an armchair, leaned back, and clicked his tongue against his palate. He wondered whether he should give the commission to Bronson, the sculptor who was a friend of Mrs. Shoup, wife of the president of Cosmo, or to Palmer, who had been recommended by Mr. Hughesby, who was planning the erection of a new $5 million cosmetic factory. Keating discovered that he liked this process of hesitation. He held the fate of two men and of many potential others. Their fate, their work, their hope, perhaps even the amount of food in their stomachs. He could choose as he pleased, for any reason, without reasons. He could flip a coin. He could count them off on the buttons of his vest. He was a great man, by the grace of those who depended on him. Then he noticed the envelope. It lay on top of a pile of letters on his desk. It was a plain, thin, narrow envelope, but it bore the small masthead of the banner in one corner. He reached for it hastily. It contained no letter, only a strip of proofs for tomorrow's banner. He saw the familiar One Small Voice by Ellsworth M. Toohey, and under it, a single word as subtitle, in large, spaced letters, a single word blatant in its singleness, a salute by dint of omission. Keating. He dropped the paper strip, and seized it again and read, choking upon great unchewed hunks of sentences, the paper trembling in his hand, the skin on his forehead drawing into tight pink spots. Toohey had written, "Greatness is an exaggeration, and like all exaggerations of dimension, it connotes at once the necessary corollary of emptiness. One thinks of an inflated toy balloon, does one not? There are, however,
occasions when we are forced to acknowledge the promise of an approach brilliantly close to what we designate loosely by the term of greatness. Such a promise is looming on our architectural horizon in the person of a mere boy named Peter Keating. We have heard a great deal, and with justice, about the superb Cosmo Slotnick building which he has designed. Let us glance for once beyond the building at the man whose personality is stamped upon it. There is no personality stamped upon that building, and in this, my friends, lies the greatness of the personality. It is the greatness of a selfless young spirit that assimilates all things and returns them to the world from which they came, enriched by the gentle brilliance of his own talent. Thus, a single man comes to represent not a lone freak, but the multitude of all men together, to embody the reach of all aspirations in his own. Those gifted with discrimination will be able to hear the message which Peter Keating addresses to us in the shape of the Cosmo Slotnick building, to see that the three simple massive ground floors are the solid bulk of our working classes, which support all of society, that the rows of identical windows offering their panes to the sun are the souls of the common people, of the countless anonymous ones alike in their uniformity of brotherhood, reaching for the light. That the graceful pilasters rising from their firm base in the ground floors and bursting into the gay effervescence of their Corinthian capitals are the flowers of culture which blossom only when rooted in the rich soil of the broad masses. In answer to those who consider all critics as fiends devoted solely to the destruction of sensitive talent, this column wishes to thank Peter Keating for affording us the rare, oh so rare, opportunity to prove our delight in our true mission, which is to discover young talent when it is there to be discovered. And if Peter Keating should chance to read these lines, we expect no gratitude from him. The gratitude is ours. It was when Keating began to read the article for the third time that he noticed a few lines written in red pencil across the space by its title. Dear Peter Keating, drop in to see me at my office one of these days. Would love to discover what you look like. EMT. He let the clipping flutter down to his desk, and he stood over it, running a strand of hair between his fingers in a kind of happy stupor. Then he whirled around to his drawing of the Cosmo Slotnick building that hung on the wall between a huge photograph of the Parthenon and one of the Louvre. He looked at the pilasters of his building. He had never thought of them as culture, flowering from out of the broad masses, but he decided that one could very well think that, and all the rest of the beautiful stuff. Then he seized the telephone. He spoke to a high, flat voice, which belonged to Ellsworth Toohey's secretary, and he made an appointment to see Toohey at 4:30 of the next afternoon. In the hours that followed, his daily work assumed a new relish. It was as if his usual activity had been only a bright, flat mural, and had now become a noble bas-relief, pushed forward, given a three-dimensional reality by the words of Ellsworth Toohey. Guy Francon descended from his office once in a while for no ascertainable purpose. The subtler shades of his shirts and socks matched the gray of his temples. He stood smiling benevolently in silence. Keating flashed past him in the drafting room and acknowledged his presence, not stopping, but slowing his steps long enough to plant a crackling bit of newspaper into the folds of the mauve handkerchief in Francon's breast pocket, with, "Read that when you have time, Guy." He added, his steps halfway across the next room, "Want to have lunch with me today, Guy? Wait for me at the plaza." When he came back from lunch, Keating was stopped by a young draftsman, who asked, his voice high with excitement, "Say, Mr. Keating, who's it took a shot at Ellsworth Toohey?" Keating managed to gasp out, "Who is it did what?"
"Shot Mr. Toohey."
"Who?"
"That's what I want to know, who?"
"Shot Ellsworth Toohey?"
"That's what I saw in the paper in the restaurant a guy had. Didn't have time to get one."
"He's killed?"
"That's what I don't know. Saw only it said about a shot."
"If he's dead, does that mean they won't publish his column tomorrow?"
"Dunno." "Why, Mr. Keating?"
"Go get me a paper."
"But I've got to—"
"Get me that paper, you damned idiot!"
The story was there in the afternoon papers. A shot had been fired at Ellsworth Toohey that morning as he stepped out of his car in front of a radio station where he was to deliver an address on The Voiceless and the Undefended. The shot had missed him. Ellsworth Toohey had remained calm and sane throughout. His behavior had been theatrical, only in too complete an absence of anything theatrical. He had said, "We cannot keep a radio audience waiting," and had hurried on upstairs to the microphone, where, never mentioning the incident, he delivered a half-hour speech from memory, as he always did. The assailant had said nothing when arrested. Keating stared, his throat dry at the name of the assailant. It was Stephen Mallory. Only the inexplicable frightened Keating, particularly when the inexplicable lay not in tangible facts, but in that causeless feeling of dread within him. There was nothing to concern him directly in what had happened, except his wish that it had been someone else, anyone but Stephen Mallory, and that he didn't know why he should wish this. Stephen Mallory had remained silent. He had given no explanation of his act. At first it was supposed that he might have been prompted by despair at the loss of his commission for the Kosmoslotnik building, since it was learned that he lived in revolting poverty. But it was learned beyond any doubt that Ellsworth Toohey had had no connection whatever with his loss. Toohey had never spoken to Mr. Slotnik about Stephen Mallory. Toohey had not seen the Statue of Industry. On this point, Mallory had broken his silence to admit that he had never met Toohey nor seen him in person before, nor known any of Toohey's friends. "Do you think that Mr. Toohey was in some way responsible for your losing that commission?" he was asked. Mallory had answered, "No." "Then why?" Mallory said nothing. Toohey had not recognized his assailant when he saw him seized by policemen on the sidewalk outside the radio station. He did not learn his name until after the broadcast. Then, stepping out of the studio into an anteroom full of waiting newsmen, Toohey said, "No, of course I won't press any charges. I wish they'd let him go. Who is he, by the way?" When he heard the name, Toohey's glance remained fixed somewhere between the shoulder of one man and the hat brim of another. Then Toohey, who had stood calmly while a bullet struck an inch from his face against the glass of the entrance door below, uttered one word, and the word seemed to fall at his feet, heavy with fear. "Why?" No one could answer. Presently, Toohey shrugged, smiled, and said, "If it was an attempt at free publicity, well, what atrocious taste." But nobody believed this explanation, because all felt that Toohey did not believe it either. Through the interviews that followed, Toohey answered questions gaily. He said, "I had never thought myself important enough to warrant assassination. It would be the greatest tribute one could possibly expect, if it weren't so much in the style of an operetta." He managed to convey the charming impression that nothing of importance had happened, because nothing of importance ever happened on Earth. Mallory was sent to jail to await trial. All efforts to question him failed. The thought that kept Keating uneasily awake for many hours that night was the groundless certainty that Toohey felt exactly as he did. "He knows," thought Keating, "and I know, that there is, in Stephen Mallory's motive, a greater danger than in his murderous attempt. But we shall never know his motive. Or shall we?" And then he touched the core of fear. It was the sudden wish that he might be guarded, through the years to come, to the end of his life, from ever learning that motive. Ellsworth Toohey's secretary rose in a leisurely manner when Keating entered, and opened for him the door into Ellsworth Toohey's office. Keating had grown past the stage of experiencing anxiety at the prospect of meeting a famous man, but he experienced it in the moment when he saw the door opening under her hand. He wondered what Toohey really looked like. He remembered the magnificent voice he had heard in the lobby of the strike meeting, and he imagined a giant of a man, with a rich mane of hair, perhaps just turning gray, with bold, broad features of an ineffable benevolence, something vaguely like the countenance of God the Father. "Mr. Peter Keating? Mr. Toohey," said the secretary, and closed the door behind him. At a first glance upon Ellsworth Monckton Toohey, one wished to offer him a heavy, well-padded overcoat. So frail and unprotected did his thin little body appear, like that of a chicken just emerging from the egg, in all the sorry fragility of unhardened bones. At a second glance, one wished to be sure that the overcoat should be an exceedingly good one, so exquisite were the garments covering that body. The lines of the dark suit followed frankly the shape within it, apologizing for nothing. They sank with the concavity of the narrow chest. They slid down from the long, thin neck with the sharp slope of the shoulders. A great forehead dominated the body. The wedge-shaped face descended from the broad temples to a small pointed chin. The hair was black, lacquered, divided into equal halves by a thin white line. This made the skull look tight and trim, but left too much emphasis to the ears that flared out in solitary nakedness, like the handles of a bouillon cup. The nose was long and thin, prolonged by the small dab of a black mustache. The eyes were dark and startling. They held such a wealth of intellect and of twinkling gaiety that his glasses seemed to be worn not to protect his eyes, but to protect other men from their excessive brilliance.
"Hello, Peter Keating," said Ellsworth Monckton Toohey in his compelling, magical voice. "What do you think of the temple of Nike Apteros?"
"How do you do, Mr. Toohey?" said Keating, stopped, stupefied.
"What do I think of what?"
"Sit down, my friend. Of the temple of Nike Apteros."
I feel certain that you couldn't have overlooked that little gem. The Parthenon has usurped the recognition which, and isn't that usually the case, the bigger and stronger appropriating all the glory, while the beauty of the unprepossessing goes unsung, which should have been awarded to that magnificent little creation of the great free spirit of Greece. You've noted, I'm sure, the fine balance of its mass, the supreme perfection of its modest proportions. Ah, yes, you know, the supreme in the modest. The delicate craftsmanship of detail?
"Yes, of course," muttered Keating. "That's always been my favorite, the temple of Nike Apteros."
"Really?"
said Ellsworth Toohey, with a smile which Keating could not quite classify.
"I was certain of it. I was certain you'd say it. You have a very handsome face, Peter Keating, when you don't stare like this, which is really quite unnecessary."
And Toohey was laughing suddenly. Laughing quite obviously, quite insultingly at Keating, and at himself. It was as if he were underscoring the falseness of the whole procedure. Keating sat aghast for an instant, and then he found himself laughing easily in answer, as if at home with a very old friend.
"That's better," said Toohey. "Don't you find it advisable not to talk too seriously in an important moment? And this might be a very important moment. Who knows, for both of us. And, of course, I knew you'd be a little afraid of me, and, oh, I admit, I was quite a bit afraid of you. So isn't this much better?"
"Oh, yes, Mr. Toohey," said Keating, happily. His normal assurance in meeting people had vanished, but he felt at ease, as if all responsibility were taken away from him, and he did not have to worry about saying the right things, because he was being led gently into saying them without any effort on his part. "I've always known it would be an important moment when I met you, Mr. Toohey. Always. For years."
"Really?"
said Ellsworth Toohey, the eyes behind the glasses attentive.
"Why?"
"Because I'd always hoped that I would please you, that you'd approve to me of my work when the time came. Why, I even—"
"Yes?"
"I even thought so often when drawing, is this the kind of a building that Ellsworth Toohey would say is good? I tried to see it like that through your eyes. I've—"
Toohey listened, watchfully.
"I've always wanted to meet you because you're such a profound thinker, and a man of such cultural distinct—"
"Now," said Toohey,
his voice kindly but a little impatient. His interest had dropped on that last sentence.
"None of that. I don't mean to be ungracious, but we'll dispense with that sort of thing, shall we? Unnatural as this may sound, I really don't like to hear personal praise."
It was Toohey's eyes, thought Keating, that put him at ease. There was such a vast understanding in Toohey's eyes, and such an unfastidious kindness. No, what a word to think of. Such an unlimited kindness. It was as if one could hide nothing from him. But it was not necessary to hide it, because he would forgive anything. They were the most unaccusing eyes that Keating had ever seen.
"But, Mr. Toohey," he muttered, "I did want to—"
"You wanted to thank me for my article," said Toohey, and made a little grimace of gay despair.
"And here I've been trying so hard to prevent you from doing it. Do let me get away with it, won't you? There's no reason why you should thank me, if you happen to deserve the things I said. Well, the credit belongs to you, not to me. Doesn't it? But I was so happy that you thought I'm a great architect. But surely, my boy, you knew that. Or weren't you quite sure?"
"Never quite sure of it."
"Well, I—"
It was only a second's pause.
and it seemed to Keating that this pause was all Tui had wanted to hear from him. Tui did not wait for the rest, but spoke as if he had received a full answer, and an answer that pleased him. And as for the Kosmoslotnik building, who can deny that it's an extraordinary achievement? You know, I was greatly intrigued by its plan. It's a most ingenious plan, a brilliant plan, very unusual, quite different from what I have observed in your previous work, isn't it? Naturally, said Keating, his voice clear and hard for the first time. The problem was different from anything I'd done before, so I worked out that plan to fit the particular requirements of the problem. Of course, said Tui, gently. A beautiful piece of work. You should be proud of it. Keating noticed that Tui's eyes stood centered in the middle of the lenses, and the lenses stood focused straight on his pupils, and Keating knew suddenly that Tui knew he had not designed the plan of the Kosmoslotnik building. This did not frighten him. What frightened him was that he saw approval in Tui's eyes. If you must feel, no, not gratitude, gratitude is such an embarrassing word, but shall we say appreciation, Tui continued, and his voice had grown softer, as if Keating were a fellow conspirator who would know that the words used were to be, from now on, a code for a private meaning. You might thank me for understanding the symbolic implications of your building, and for stating them in words as you stated them in marble, since, of course, you are not just a common mason, but a thinker in stone. Yes, said Keating. That was my abstract theme when I designed the building, the great masses and the flowers of culture. I've always believed that true culture springs from the common man, but I had no hope that anyone would ever understand me. Tui smiled. His thin lips slid open. His teeth showed. He was not looking at Keating. He was looking down at his own hand, the long, slender, sensitive hand of a concert pianist, moving a sheet of paper on the desk. Then he said, Perhaps we're brothers of the spirit, Keating, the human spirit. That is all that matters in life. Not looking at Keating, but past him, the lenses raised flagrantly to a line over Keating's face. And Keating knew that Tui knew he had never thought of any abstract theme until he'd read that article. And more, that Tui approved again. When the lenses moved slowly to Keating's face, the eyes were sweet with affection, an affection very cold and very real. Then Keating felt as if the walls of the room were moving gently in upon him, pushing him into a terrible intimacy, not with Tui, but with some unknown guilt. He wanted to leap to his feet and run. He sat still, his mouth half open. And without knowing what prompted him, Keating heard his own voice in the silence. And I did want to say how glad I was that you escaped that maniac's bullet yesterday, Mr. Tui.
Oh? Oh, thanks. That, well, don't let it upset you. Just one of the minor penalties one pays for prominence in public life.
I've never liked Mallory. A strange sort of person, too tense. I don't like people who are tense. I've never liked his work, either.
Just an exhibitionist. Won't amount to much.
It wasn't my idea, of course, to give him a try. It was Mr. Slotnick's. Pull, you know. But Mr. Slotnick knew better in the end.
Did Mallory ever mention my name to you?
No, never.
I haven't even met him, you know. Never saw him before. Why did he do it?
And then it was Tui who sat still, before what he saw in Keating's face. Tui, alert and insecure for the first time. This was it, thought Keating. This was the bond between them. And the bond was fear. And more, much more than that. But fear was the only recognizable name to give it. And he knew with unreasoning finality that he liked Tui better than any man he had ever met. Well, you know how it is, said Keating brightly, hoping that the commonplace he was about to utter would close the subject. Mallory is an incompetent and knows it, and he decided to take it out on you as on a symbol of the great and the able. But instead of a smile, Keating saw the shot of Tui's sudden glance at him. It was not a glance, it was a fluoroscope. He thought he could feel it crawling, searchingly inside his bones. Then Tui's face seemed to harden, drawing together again in composure, and Keating knew that Tui had found relief somewhere. In his bones, or in his gaping, bewildered face, that some hidden immensity of ignorance within him had given Tui reassurance. Then Tui said slowly, strangely, derisively,
You and I, we're going to be great friends, Peter.
Keating let a moment pass before he caught himself to answer hastily.
"Oh, I hope so, Mr. Toohey."
"Really, Peter, I'm not as old as all that, am I? Ellsworth is the monument to my parents' peculiar taste in nomenclature."
"Yes, Ellsworth."
"That's better. I really don't mind the name when compared to some of the things I've been called privately and publicly these many years." "Oh, well, flattering. When one makes enemies, one knows that one's dangerous where it's necessary to be dangerous. There are things that must be destroyed, or they'll destroy us. We'll see a great deal of each other, Peter."
The voice was smooth and sure now, with the finality of a decision tested and reached, with the certainty that never again would anything in Keating be a question mark to him.
"For instance, I've been thinking for some time of getting together a few young architects, I know so many of them, just an informal little organization to exchange ideas, you know, to develop a spirit of cooperation, to follow a common line of action for the common good of the profession if necessity arises. Nothing as stuffy as the AGA. Just a youth group. Think you'd be interested?"
"Why, of course. And you'd be the chairman?"
"Oh, dear, no, I'm never chairman of anything, Peter. I dislike titles. No, I rather thought you'd make the right chairman for us. Can't think of anyone better."
"Me?"
"You, Peter." "Oh, well, it's only a project. Nothing definite, just an idea I've been toying with in odd moments. We'll talk about it some other time. There's something I'd like you to do, and that's really one of the reasons why I wanted to meet you."
"Oh, sure, Mr. Too."
"Sure, Ellsworth.
Anything I can do for you."
"It's not for me. Do you know Lois Cook?"
"Lois who?"
"Cook. You don't, but you will. That young woman is the greatest literary genius since Goethe. You must read her, Peter. I don't suggest that as a rule, except to the discriminating. She's so much above the heads of the middle class who love the obvious. She's planning to build a house, a little private residence on the Bowery. Yes, on the Bowery, just like Lois. She's asked me to recommend an architect. I'm certain that it will take a person like you to understand a person like Lois. I'm going to give her your name, if you're interested in what is to be a small, though quite costly, residence."
"But of course, that's very kind of you, Ellsworth. You know, I thought when you said, and when I read your note, that you wanted, well, some favor from me, you know, a good turn for a good turn. And here you're..."
"My dear Peter, how naive you are."
"Oh, I suppose I shouldn't have said that. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to offend you. I
don't mind. You must learn to know me better. Strange as it may sound, a totally selfless interest in one's fellow men is possible in this world, Peter."
Then they talked about Lois Cook and her three published works.
"Novels. No, Peter, not exactly novels. No, not collections of stories, either. That's just it. Just Lois Cook, a new form of literature entirely."
About the fortune she had inherited from a long line of successful tradesmen, and about the house she planned to build. It was only when Toohey had risen to escort Keating to the door, and Keating noticed how precariously erect he stood on his very small feet, that Toohey paused suddenly to say,
"Incidentally, it seems to me as if I should remember some personal connection between us, though for the life of me I can't quite place..." "Oh, yes, of course. My niece, little Catherine."
Keating felt his face tighten, and knew he must not allow this to be